Today's Teisho is on case 9 in the Heikigan Roku, the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 9 is entitled Joshu's Four Gates. Engo's Introduction. In the bright mirror on its stand, beauty and ugliness are revealed. With the Bakuya sword in hand, killing and sparing are brought under control. A handsome fellow disappearing, an ugly one comes. An ugly fellow disappearing, a handsome one comes. Life found in death, death in life. If you have no eye to penetrate the barrier, no freedom to turn about, you will be lost on the way. Tell me, what is the eye that penetrates the barrier? What is the freedom to turn about? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? Joshu said, the east gate, the west gate, the north gate, the south gate. Secho's verse. Its intention concealed, the question came. The diamond king's eye was as clear as a jewel. There stood the gates, north, east, south, and west, but the heaviest hammer blow could not open them. Glad that you're here today to practice Zen. And I regret very much that we weren't able to do kinhin outside, but it seems that the band practice is still going on. And I'm sure that this will have an end, as all things do. And in a couple weeks, we'll be able to do kinhin outside. That will be a real treat. But nevertheless, it's even in the hallway, being able to take a mindful step and another mindful step, moving forward, that's a beautiful experience in its own right, especially after sitting for since 7 o'clock this morning. Being able to get up and stretch your legs is really a treat. Quite wonderful. Ordinarily, walking is just walking. It's even a burden. But after an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours of meditation, when you walk, it's this wonderful, wonderful experience. So today I got up and I had a little breakfast. I had a cup of tea. And I got in my car. I was very excited about coming here to do Zazen. I look forward very much to Saturday sits. And I was driving down the road, and it's beautiful, beautiful morning, really. The weather, you know, New Jersey weather can be quite difficult to deal with in the summer, but this summer has just been amazing. You know, relatively low humidity. Beautiful. Temperature's not too hot. And this morning was no exception. I was driving and really enjoying myself. And I was probably driving just a little too fast. And as I was driving, all of a sudden, in front of me, a group of little birds must have been on the pavement, and they sprang up. And they were probably like chickadees or a very small bird. Maybe chickadees, I think. But anyway, they must have been eating some seeds on the road, and as I drove by, I didn't see them until it was too late. And they flew very quickly past the car, but one of them didn't, I suspect, one of them didn't make it. And I really felt terrible about this. It really bummed me out. I was driving to come here, and I could feel the shine off my mind, you know, come off my mind. And I felt guilty. And then I it took me a while. Actually, I was sitting here this morning, and I realized, look, you know, that was an accident. You know, I didn't choose to hurt that little bird. You know, let yourself off the hook, please. And I don't think I'm rationalizing. I didn't go, where's a bird? You know, let me hit him with my car. I was enjoying the morning, and the bird was on the road, and I didn't see it in time. I realized that this is a very human thing to do, actually, you know. We really want to believe that we're in total control, you know, total control. And we would rather feel guilty, even, and even be mad at ourselves, rather than admit that there's a lot of things in life we just don't control. It was hard for me to sort it out. You know, I was actually feeling badly because I hit this bird. I was feeling guilty, and I was feeling like I had, you know, somehow done something wrong. I wasn't really even speeding. I was just driving my car, you know, but it was too fast to correct my mistake. But it wasn't really a mistake, you know. I didn't mean to hit the bird, but I didn't choose to hit the bird. This idea that we would rather be mad at ourselves, and we'd rather be really, really mad at ourselves, or even hurt ourselves in a certain way, rather than admit that we don't have control. And some things are just going to unfold as they unfold. And it takes a great deal, I think, of wisdom and a lot of sitting to realize this and to say, okay, things are unfolding as they have to unfold. And I did my best. I did my best, you know. I was reading something. I got interested in Zen about 20... no, more than that, almost 34 years ago. I was 22, and I started reading books on Zen and was fascinated by this Zen, this thing called Zen. And I began to drive all my friends crazy because they would say something and I would say, you know, that reminds me very much of Zen. And it wouldn't matter what they were talking about. They might be talking about art or football or eating. And I was just like reading books on Zen all the time. And so no matter what, it always came back to Zen. I always brought it back to Zen somehow. And it drove my friends and family crazy. I think they eventually let it go. You know, they realized this was not going to stop. Now, I'm only like that about 30% of the time. So sometimes there are some times when I'm not actually connecting everything to Zen. But this week I was reading the papers a couple times, and I thought, oh, this is related to Zen. I was reading that some psychologists, I know some of you are studying or psychologists are going to get to advanced degrees in psychology. Psychologists were studying how rats deal with aggression. And I guess it was mice, not rats. I think it was mice. How mice deal with aggression. And what happens is that there are some mice that are very aggressive, and they intimidate the other mice. And they have, you know, sort of like bred some mice to be like super aggressive mice. And they put them into a big cage with some less aggressive mice. And the aggressive mice dominate the less aggressive mice. And they said that the change that takes place in the less aggressive mice is very dramatic, you know. they begin to become withdrawn. They begin to demonstrate like neurotic symptoms, you know. So they retreat to one end of the cage. They walk around in circles. They're cowering, and they say they eventually develop a lot of symptoms of chronic stress, you know. They begin to exhibit all the signs of like being chronically stressed and depressed, depression, mouse depression. And they were fascinated to see how this unequal relationship affects the less aggressive mice, that they become depressed, they become unhappy, and they begin to become neurotic. You know, they pace around in a little circle, they do things that are sort of dysfunctional. And they said, but there was one exception in their experiment, and that was when they put a wheel in the cage. They'd put two things in the cage, along with the very dominant mouse. They put a wheel, and one of those wheels, like a hamster wheel. And they also put in like a little mouse maze, like a little mouse fun house. And apparently mice could go into these holes in this block, and they could, it was like a plexiglass block, and they could tunnel, go through all these tunnels and explore these mazes and so on and so on, you know. And it turns out that the mice who had access to these devices didn't exhibit any of those stress-related symptoms. That the mice who could get on the exercise wheel were vigorous and very healthy. And they weren't didn't seem neurotic at all. And also the mice who could go into like the fun house, you know, and they could go through these little tunnels and explore and pop out here and pop out there, they also were very lively and vigorous and healthy. And I thought that was fascinating, you know, because in our society, you know, we have, how shall I put it? Our society is, I think, not especially in all ways a healthy society. And people have to put up with a lot of events in their lives that they can't control. You know, a friend of mine she has a boss who makes these arbitrary decisions and really makes her life very difficult. And she has no ability to tell the boss, see here, you know, what you're going to do is going to have a bad impact on everybody who works in my store. You know, the boss makes a decision, and it's this woman's job to carry it out. This is the dilemma of, like, middle management, right? You don't get to make the policy, you just have to enforce it. And so she has a lot of stress, you know, and... you know, one of the things she does to cope with her stress is jog, and it helps her a lot. You know, and also I myself have similar situation. You know, I have to put up with people. I work in an institution, Rutgers. You know, and you know there'll be some dean who will cut my budget back, and you know the dean just looks at figures on a piece of paper and says, okay, you have to cut $200,000. And I'll say, you know, I'll see that means certain people lose their jobs or certain services aren't delivered or, you know, working conditions are not as good as they were. And so, you know, it's stressful for me. It creates a stress. And I too jog, but I also like to meditate, as you know. You know, so I'll sit down on the cushion, and after an hour and a half, it's like liberation, you know, liberation. And this has been like a tool. These two things, you know, exercise and meditation, have been like tools that I've had all my life. And they've helped me so much. You know, they're really wonderful tools. And I have been, when I read this article about the mice, I thought, you know, this is so obvious in a way, you know, that this is sort of our world too, right? Where we're in the cage and we don't necessarily get to control everything. The big mouse gets to control it all. And we're the little mice, but how do we keep from feeling helpless? And how do we keep our spirits up and keep our creative edge, and so on, you know? And I think maybe meditation is like that fun house, you know? You can explore reality in different ways, and when you go through it, you come out on the other side and you feel just wonderful. I was also reading something else that that I thought really really was quite appropriate. It was an article about Korea. Some of you might know a little bit about Korea, but you know, Korea. Around the time I was born, in the mid-50s, Korea was one of the poorest countries in the world. And most people wouldn't have thought Korea would ever achieve very much. It's a relatively small country. It's mostly mountainous. It has very few natural resources. And yet now, 50-some years later, it's like the 15th largest economy in the world, even though they only have about 50 million people. They've worked tremendously hard, but their society is in some ways really falling apart. This article was talking about the fact that in Korea there's like an epidemic of suicides. And it's getting to be so dramatic that it's become a subject of a lot of concern for the whole society, because many people who are like distinguished people commit suicide in Korea. In fact, the suicide rate in Korea is apparently three times as high as it is in the United States, and our rate is rather high. The Koreans are quite used to now, like opening up their newspaper in the morning and learning that some movie actress, or some political figure, or some intellectual has committed suicide, and it's happening, you know, right and left. And the article was saying, well, why is this happening? You know, and you know, Korea used to be a Confucian and Buddhist society. And people were told it's very important to take care of others. You know, don't put yourself forward. Basically be humble and take care of one another. And so on and so on. And it basically communal society. It was a communal society, villages, small cities, and people were basically rural people, and they were educated to be, small number of them were educated to be leaders, but most people were peasants, you know, and they had a mentality of like typical village people. Of taking care of your family, not aspiring too much, you know, keep your head down and work hard, be happy for what you have, you know, don't expect too much from life. And you know, so modernization came in, and the Korean people have become a highly technologically advanced society. Everybody is seeking higher degrees, advanced education. They're intensely competitive. intensely competitive. And basically, they're really quite unhappy as a society. They don't really take care of each other anymore. They're constantly comparing each other, comparing themselves to one another. And they were talking to psychiatrists and sociologists, and they were all saying, you know, this is the transition we've gone through. You know, we went from this village society where people were encouraged not to put themselves forward, to be part of the group. And now we're in a society where everybody's urged to compete intensely. And, of course, nobody can be good enough. Nobody can be really good. You know, there's always somebody who's better. And so even like recently a Korean actress who was very highly regarded committed suicide. And, you know, who knows why, but a lot of people who are even, we would say, very successful don't see themselves as successful enough. And they blame themselves, you know, they blame themselves and commit suicide. And so the society is in a really tough spot, you know, because they've modernized very quickly, and they've become hyper competitive, and you know, basically people don't feel supported by one another anymore. They don't feel cared for anymore, and so you have like a lot of individual unhappiness. When I was reading this, I thought, you know, they have gone through this process very quickly, but we've been through this process too. You know, our society today is somewhat like this, I think, you know. We're very competitive. You know, we're not necessarily taught to take care of one another, you know, look after other people's welfare. And so on and so on. And also, I think we grow, if we're not careful, we all have a little bit of an inferiority complex. You know, we all feel that we're maybe not, you know, we're not where we should be in life, you know. I think this is fairly common, you know, where people, you know, people are measuring themselves against other people, finding that they're not, you know, they're not, you know, president of the corporation, you know, so on and so on. And I think this is like a formula for unhappiness, actually. I think it's like, you know, people experience life as individuals, you know, but it's really like the whole culture that sends these signals, and everybody just takes these values into themselves, it takes these values to heart. And then find themselves rather unhappy without really figuring out that it's not necessarily their fault. You know, that this is, so they're sort of like doing what they're told. So anyway, I thought the case of Korea was quite interesting, and it was like looking in a mirror and seeing in some ways a distorted image of our own society, you know. And I of course, being who I am, I thought, oh, this reminds me of Zen, you know. Someday, I really want to do it. We really should try to have a tea ceremony, Japanese tea ceremony. When I was training in Zen, my second teacher, Webb, began to be very interested in Chado, C-H-A-D-O, the way of tea, which is really, really quite a beautiful ritual. If you, after the talk today, if you feel like it, you might do a Google search, and you might type in Japanese tea ceremony or Chado, and there will probably be a tape, and it will show a tea ceremony. And if you watch it, I think you'll find that it's quite beautiful, very simple, and it's very. It was really invented by a lay Buddhist, lay Zen teacher whose name was Senno Rikyu. And Rikyu was very interested in trying to develop forms of meditation practice that ordinary people could do. Because, you know, in Japan, in the 16th and 17th centuries, people didn't all do zazen. You know, farmers and merchants, seamen and, soldiers, you know, they didn't necessarily do zazen. Maybe they couldn't do zazen, you know, but Rikyu tried to come up with simple activities, rituals, that people could do that would help them to get into samadhi, help them to get into that very calm, centered state of awareness that we reach when we sit on the cushion. And he came up with a very simple ceremony that required almost no tools, you know, things that anybody in Japan could easily make or buy. And the tea ceremony involves you need a bowl, you need hot water, you need a little whisk. Like, it looks like a bamboo version of the whisks we use in our kitchen. And there's a person who serves the tea, and you take this beautiful green powdered tea and you put it in a bowl, and then you add hot water, and you take the whisk and you whisk up the powdered tea into this frothy green liquid. It's beautiful. It's very thick. And it's really quite extraordinary. It looks like, I don't know how to describe it, but it's just quite beautiful just to look at. And then you serve that bowl of tea to your guests. You know, you might have two or three guests and they're lined up in a row facing you, and you make the tea. And then you serve the tea. And usually before the tea is served, the guests all eat a sweet. There's usually like a little sweet made of mung bean paste or some chestnut cookie. And when you see the tea is going to be served, before it's served, you eat your cookie. And then the server puts the bowl in front of you. And then, you know, the thing you're never supposed to do ever in tea ceremony is say thank you and drink it. What you're supposed to do is offer it to the person next to you first. And then that person is supposed to decline the gift, and then you can drink it. You know, so there's a lesson here, right? You enter deep samadhi, and you're waiting patiently for this wonderful experience, right? This wonderful experience of you're going to be served this bowl of tea, which is really almost like magical if you're in the right state of mind. And when the bowl comes to you, you have to remember to think of the other person first. So you always offer it, and then that person always is thinking of you, right? I'm thinking of you. You know, so here's the tea. No, you first. Go ahead. Enjoy yourself, see? And so then you've offered it, and the person has declined, and now you can drink it. You try to drink it down in three swallows, and then you give it back to the server, and the server cleans it in a ritual way, and then serves it to the next person. See, and the message here is, thinking of others, right? Others, you know, my teacher used to say, others before self. Others before self. And this is really very much part of Zen, you know. When we do Zen practice for a while, something happens to us, you know. I mean, it's not always the case, but often when people start to do Zen practice, they're really interested in maybe relieving their own pain, it might be psychological pain, it might be some other, relieving one's own suffering. Sometimes when you get off the cushion and you go outside, you'll be very moved by other people you encounter. It's like you're opened up in a way that's a little odd, a little strange, a little different, you know. One person who's in our group told me once that she left the zendo, or she had been sitting, and she went out and saw a face, and she said it was so beautiful, just looking at somebody's face in the street, that she was just filled with love, and she didn't even know this person. It was just seeing that face, was just this love came welling up. See, now I think this is this is part of Zen practice. You know, this somehow when we sit on the cushion, you know, we begin to open up. You know, I was reading this wonderful book that Kriti gave me by a man named Rob Preece. He's a psychotherapist and a Vipassana practitioner. And he said something so, it was just right on. You know, you can tell he's done a lot of sitting. He said, sometimes in life we go through experiences that are very painful and difficult. And he said, what happens to us is we contract. It's just like contraction. And it's like, normally the boundary between ourselves and the world is a little bit open, right? And then something hurts us and we contract. And then when we're in that contracted state, we become a little bit paranoid. We begin maybe to feel unhappy about ourselves, you know, who we are, and begin to compare ourselves with other people, and find ourselves wanting, and so on and so on. And he said, but, you know, if you work through your obstacles, you begin to open up again. And there's a state in which we begin to expand more and more. You know, when you start sitting, sometimes the focus is me. And then, you know, after a while, the focus isn't me anymore. You hear the blower, or you hear a bird. It's like these circles get wider and wider and wider. And the boundary between yourself and the world opens up. And there's this, it's like you can suddenly breathe. You know, it's like you can breathe. When we're in that contracted state, it's hard even to breathe. I think we're literally, you know, you feel tight. And when you're beginning to, you know, you sit on the cushion, you breathe through your diaphragm, your dantian, the breath goes out, your consciousness goes out. And, you know, little by little, you know, fear and anxiety begin to drop away, and the boundary gets bigger, right, bigger. And then, you know, we begin to feel this wonderful sense of connectedness to things, you know? I think this is really quite a healthy way to be, you know, really healthy. It's what human life is all about, you know, really. People do things, I think, that help them enter that expanded state. You know, we all have things we love. I mean, for some people it's jogging. You know, I like to go to art museums. I love visual arts. And when I'm in a museum, I just feel, you know, the beautiful colors on the canvas sort of draw my mind out of my small self. And I begin to feel very much alive. It's like that feeling of being outside or beyond the normal boundaries of the contracted self is just so wonderful. Hiking, you know, you're out in nature, you turn and you see this mountain vista. It might not be anything dramatic, it might just be leaves on a rock, and you just feel this wonderful sense of a fusion between yourself and the world. That's really great, right? And Zen is like an art of fusion. In fact, you know, the word Zen Zen is from the Japanese Zen, and the Japanese basically borrowed that from Chan, the Chinese Chan, and Chan is really the Chinese version of the word jhana. So in Sanskrit the word is jhana, and then it became Chan in China, and then it became Zen in Japan, because the Japanese don't have a CH sound. The word Zen, or the word Chan, or Jhana, is often translated as meditation. But if you read a book on Zen, sometimes they'll say Chan means meditation. But that can't be right, because all the Buddhist schools have meditation. What Chan or Zen really means is a fusion. So, you know, when we're in that contracted state, everything can be very unsatisfying, right? And, you know, traumatic events or difficult or painful events, you know, can be, make us contract into ourselves. And in that state, things are usually quite unsatisfactory. That's almost like, you know, like falling from heaven, you know, really. You can be in this wonderful state, and then you come home and you get some bad news, and you can just go right down. You know, it's like you contract right away. And you contract, and then basically it's as though now everything is separate from yourself. And that's where we enter into this mindset of comparing and judging ourselves and others, and dissatisfactions arise, and self-distrust, all of these familiar features of modern life. And in some ways, you know, I think our society doesn't really encourage people to be outside the small self. I think a lot of things in our society cause us to contract. You know, you're sort of taught to be in a contracted state. I sometimes think that I have a good friend who is just changed jobs. He's in the business world. He's in computers. He's a programmer and, software architect, you could say. And he was unhappy in his job, and then he changed jobs recently. And he got this new job, and for about a week he was really excited about the job because it was going to mean more money and new opportunities. But when he got on the job, he said that his boss brought him in and said and showed him the architecture of the I don't know enough to describe it accurately, but basically showed him the program and said, "You can understand this, can't you? You know, or like, you can see this at a glance and understand it." And my friend is actually a very good person. He was a top student, but he said, you know, he said to the boss, "Oh yes, of course." And of course, then he went home and he couldn't sleep for 2 days because, of course, it would take a long time to really figure out the architecture of this system. And I was wondering when he told me this story, maybe the boss wanted him to be tense, you know, really. Maybe the boss was thinking, if I make you worried enough, you'll work very, very, very hard, and you won't bother me for a raise. You'll just be happy you're still have a job. You know. Maybe the boss isn't that sinister or calculating, but who knows, you know. There's a lot in our society that doesn't encourage people to be expansive and open. And we have a very competitive society. I think this is why all these people in Korea are tossing themselves off of buildings or hanging themselves with their belts. It's not really healthy to be in that state. When we find ourselves in that state, we have to remind ourselves that this is not where we should be. And you can spend a lot of time in that state. You know, maybe it's socially encouraged to spend a lot of time there. But please don't. You know, one of the beautiful things about Zazen is that if you do it regularly, you can exit that state very quickly. You know, my friend actually does Zazen. And when he told me the story of how his boss had scared the pants off of him and prevented him from sleeping for 2 days, and naturally I said, "Well, I hope you're doing your Zazen." And basically, he said, "Yes, you know, I am, and it is helping." But, you know, Zazen is like, I think, naturally healthy thing to do. Running is like naturally healthy. you need good shoes, you have to take it easy on yourself, but generally speaking, if you get exercise, it helps you, it doesn't hurt you. It's like natural. And you'll notice, you know, I am a runner even now, and you know, I'll be stressed and I'll start running, and as the miles go by, the stress is going out the window. And by the end of the run or the walk or the run-walk, I will feel pretty darn good, you know, and everything is a little bit brighter, everything's a little bit more open. And you sit down on the cushion and you can be thinking, oh my God, how did I ever get this job, you know? Wait till they discover what a phony I am, that I really am a dunce and an idiot, you know, and so on. And then you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath and you enter samadhi. And samadhi is really like sacred. It's really like the most wonderful thing. Because the boundary between yourself and the world begins to go away and you begin to feel at home in the world. This is like so important. So it's what, if somebody asked me, what is Zen all about? I would say, you know, people think Buddhism is about detachment. But I think that's totally wrong. You know, I think Buddhism is about being at home in the world. And in a certain way, it's very difficult to be at home in the world because, you know, we live in a society that's very competitive, and the values of the society are not designed with people's happiness in mind, actually, you know. And also, you know, we live in a world of symbols and ideas, concepts that are also false to some degree. You know, there's somewhat true and somewhat false. So our symbols never really work out either. You know, we rely on our, you know, structures like jobs and political systems, and we rely on money, which is not very good thing to rely on. Because, as you know, the financial system is insane, right? So you can't trust that. Language is not reliable either, right? So somebody might say to you, well, you're a man, be manly. You know, what does that mean? Does it mean I should go around punching people? Does it mean, you know, so language is full of traps and illusions too. You know, words are not reliable either. You know, so we live in a world of culture and ideas, and they're not reliable or always very healthy either. You know, so Zazen, I think, is really special because you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, and you enter this state of non-conceptual, non-verbal oneness with things. And it's really, I think, quite unique. You know, it's that deep sense of samadhi, that deep at home in the world. And if you spend a little time at home in the world every day, you gain a kind of trust or confidence in things that can be tremendously helpful. If you spend too much time in the world of language and finance and competition and so on and so on, you're probably almost guaranteeing that you'll be unhappy. If you spend a lot of time thinking about how much you wish you were somebody else, right, that's like a very unhappy state, formula for unhappiness. If you are comparing yourself to others, that's like a formula for unhappiness. And it also is an illusion because it assumes that, you know, basically your life could have been different from what it is, right? You know, my friend, John, I have a friend, John Godfrey is his name, Eshin Godfrey. We used to be quite good friends. I haven't talked to him in 20 years, I guess. So when I say friend, I mean an old friend. But we trained together at the Seattle Zen Center before he became a student of Joshu Suzaki Roshi. And John Godfrey was like a computer whiz. He was a programmer, and he was in such demand in Seattle. He used to tell me that people would call him on the phone and say, you know, we want you to do some programming for me. And John would say, you know, he'd be so busy, he didn't want to take on any more work. And so the guy would say, can we get you to work for me? And John would say, to discourage him, he didn't want to say no. So he'd say, well, here's my price. And he'd pull some figure out of the air, and the guy would usually go, yes, okay, we'll pay that. And so John was in that kind of an enviable situation. This was when computers were just getting off the ground, and programmers were these godlike figures, you know. And John was riding so high. And you know, 10 years later, he was really almost unemployable as a programmer. He hadn't kept up. The profession had moved on. No, you know, it's possible to blame yourself for something like that. You know, why didn't my friend become Bill Gates? You know, he could. You know, there were other people who were also in the computer business when Bill Gates. By the way, did I ever tell you I almost got a job for Microsoft? This is true. When I was living in Microsoft used to be in Albuquerque, New Mexico, before it relocated to Seattle. And I answered an ad in the newspaper for a technical writer. And I went to Microsoft's offices in Albuquerque, and they were just like a little bunch of offices, this little office complex. And I went to the interview, and the guy said, so you want to be a technical writer here? And I said, yes. And he said, well, type this. And he gave me some, and I'm a terrible typist. And so I typed it, and there were a lot of errors in it. And he looked at me with a scowl, and like, you're no good. And I was going to say something like, I thought you wanted a writer, not a typist. But I just said thank you and left, you know. That wasn't Bill Gates. That's not where this story is going. But it was somebody who worked for Bill Gates. Maybe it was one of his lieutenants. And then he moved to Seattle, and I missed my chance to work for Microsoft. If only I had been a better typer, I might be a millionaire, a billionaire today. You know, it's all my fault, see. But, you know, not really, you know. Things happen, and sometimes we can't control them, you know. And when we're in our small self, when we're in that contracted self, you know, we're in this mode of reasoning that is very unhealthy. It's like, well, I could have been Bill Gates. I could be so-and-so. I could, you know. And this kind of mentality is quite, makes people stay up all night with worry and maybe put in extra hours on the job, which is okay if you love what you do, but if your motive is fear, that's like a really unhealthy place to be. So what does this have to do with koan? A monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? Joshu said, the east gate, the west gate, the north gate, the south gate. You know. Maybe it's obvious what the connection is. You know, Zen is all about being open in all directions. You know, it's about that state of being, that state of experience, where we feel open in all directions. You know, it takes a fair amount of meditation, but sometimes you just come in on a Thursday, Wednesday night, and you sit down on the cushion, and all of a sudden you're in that place, right? You feel like you can see in all directions. You're open, that open self, that connected self, that trusting self. And we know when we're there, and we know when we're not there, right? But there is a way to get from the closed up self, the contracted self, to this other self. And it's the more time you spend there, I think that it's like you become really a healthy person, really happy person. And I think it's possible to be quite creative. One more little story, and I'll stop, I promise. I was reading, there's some two, I think they're psychologists, or they might be, I think they're psychologists. They did a study of poor people. And they found that poor people are actually cognitively impaired because they because they're constantly under stress. They did a study of farmers in India, and they found that farmers who grow sugar cane have when they plant their cane and they if they have a good year, they sell their sugar cane, and for a while they have a lot of money. And they're very secure with themselves and very secure with their place in the world. And this sounds crazy, but they've given them intelligence tests, and they score very well on the intelligence test. Then, you know, farmers, same farmers, you know, they have bad years where the price of sugar drops. And they sell their sugar, and they have almost no money. And they're worried. Everything becomes very frightening to them. And they give them intelligence tests, and they score much less well on the same test. You know, it's not the same questions, but same kind of test. And they said it's as though they're less intelligent under those kinds of conditions. And they've actually replicated this. They even did it at Harvard. They ran a study with Harvard students, and they allowed the students to borrow. They were taking tests, and if they ran out of time, they could borrow time from a time bank. But it meant when they took the next test, they'd have less time. So they began to borrow too heavily on the time bank, and then their performance on these tests began to decline. And the more time stressed they were, the worse they performed. You know, the more work. Isn't that interesting? And so, you know, actually, that contracted state is really bad for us in a million different ways. And you know, when the farmers have the money in the bank, you know, they're feeling secure. They're feeling like they have some control over things. You know, their intelligence goes way up. You know, they're actually more observant. You know, Krishnamurti said something. Krishnamurti, he said, "Fear kills the mind." And I think that's so true, right? You know, that fearful contracted state. In that fearful contracted state, it's so difficult to be intelligent. You know, intelligence is really not about your brain cells. It's about being open to things as they unfold. You know, we can't always sell our sugar cane and have a big bank account. But I think there's something about Zen which is like that, you know. You enter into this state where you feel connected, and the world becomes your ally. It's like the world becomes your ally. And in that state, you have the confidence to be intelligent, you know. Anyway. I'm sure you've had those moments on the cushion, and please spend a lot of time there, and we'll all have a beautiful life.